2007 meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. Hope you had a good weekend and are ready to work hard this week. And I will open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 78A. Mr. Stembridge, would you please tell us about this bill?
Senate Bill 78A allows candidates or their treasurers to designate other persons to sign and certify contribution and expenditure statements. It allows candidates or treasurers to designate another person to receive campaign notices. It requires filing officers to send notices to candidates or treasurers or to the designated persons. It clarifies that a default or violation by a treasurer is considered a default or violation by the candidate or the treasurer. It establishes deadlines for legislators to file statements of contributions received during a legislative session, and it allows the Secretary of State to charge a fee of $500 for delivering a statewide list of electors. You have the -A5 amendment from Representative Buckley, which requires a political committee treasurer to designate a second person to receive filing officer notices.
Yeah, and Representative Buckley, would you like to tell us about your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, if you recall, a few months back, we actually passed a bill through to allow and actually to require two people involved with a political action committee to file to make sure that notices don't just go to one person who somehow messes up and the committee ends up being fined. It's the same kind of communication Canada committees have. The Senate Majority Leader really liked that bill so much that she decided to make it her own and remove the language that we passed and put in different language for a different reason. So in discussing with her the best way to move across the idea that we had passed in the House, she suggested this bill might be the best vehicle for us to get into statute the provision that we wanted. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. We have a few people signed up to testify. This is the Secretary of State's bill, so I think I will call them first, and I'll call John Lindbeck. Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. This bill is the product of working mostly with Kevin Neely from Student E-Systems, who had some issues that he wanted to address in CNE law in regards to some changes that he thought would be beneficial given the new electronic filing system. And we were fine with them. We think they're good changes, and we support them. The first section of the bill would allow a candidate to designate a person to file statements within the ORSTAR system, a third person, of contributions and expenditures. One of the issues that's come up since we implemented ORSTAR is that some committees, particularly those who use vendors, to help them. Under current law, it says only a candidate or a treasurer can file a statement, and then so the vendor prepares it for you for the candidate, and then the candidate has to go in and file it. This has caused some delays and problems for some of the committees, and this bill would allow that third person, most likely a vendor, to go in and actually file the statement for you in the ORSTAR system and skip that step. One of the things we should point out, though, is that for committees that do that, it's not required, but for committees that do that, the liability for the accuracy of the information still rests with the candidate and the treasurer. It doesn't get transferred to that third person. The second provision of this bill that I believe is important was the one Representative Buckley was just mentioning, and you folks discussed in an earlier bill, that some committees receive those committees that aren't candidate committees receive just one notice. This would require, under Representative Buckley's amendment, that those committees designate a second person so that they receive notices, late filing notices and so on, would alleviate a problem that has been happening with some committees where if somebody ignores the notices, the rest of the committee doesn't know about it.
And, John, this has no effect on any cases that might have happened previously. It doesn't take away any fines or anything.
That's
just
correct.
Makes that requirement in the future.
That's correct.
Okay.
The third important provision of this bill is that it changes the deadline for filing CNE statements within ORSTAR. It's now at 5 p.m. It will change that deadline to midnight. This is another request. We have no objection to that. One thing that I do want to point out, though, is that we do not plan to have staff on duty between 5 p.m. and midnight. So to the extent that you choose to do that and run into problems, there won't be staff available to help you until the next morning. And that is our only concern with changing this, is that there could be an expectation by some people that we'll have people on till midnight. Of course, we don't have that in the budget and have no plans to do that. The final provision of this bill that I want to point out to you is the one having to do with the charge for the statewide election list. That charge of $500 to obtain a copy of our statewide voter registration list is currently in rule, and this would move it into statute. And we requested this provision be put in the bill. The reason for it is we've had some requests for copies of this statewide list and have been getting some heat about how much we're charging for it. And some people expect that we should be giving them a copy of the voter registration list with all that information about each voter in Oregon for next to nothing. We've had trouble under current statute identifying, with the help of our vendor, the actual cost for producing that list. And as you may know, current statute says that for charging for information like this, state agencies should be charging only the actual cost. And we've been having trouble identifying that actual cost. The vendor is unable to help us, and we have been getting some arguments that we ought not to be charging virtually anything. I got very concerned about that because of the potential for using that list for identity theft. And when I read in the papers that the legislature had an interest in identity theft issues, I thought it was probably a good time to argue that we ought to move that $500 fee from rule into statute so it wouldn't be covered by that other statute about actual cost. And so that's why we asked for that provision to be in the law. This does not change anything else about the distribution of those lists. The political parties are still under statute entitled to free copies of the list before each primary and general election. And as far as I know, a lot of candidates get help from their political party in getting copies of it, and all of that is perfectly allowable. So that's it, Madam Chair.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Lindbeck? Yes, Mr. Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Lindbeck. I have a couple questions, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
The 12 midnight change, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that sets up an expectation that there's going to be somebody there, and if you have trouble with that electronic transfer, so I wonder why this is in here. I think it sets up an unreasonable expectation for people.
Well, I think you'd probably hear a better argument for this from the people who asked for this change, and Mr. Neely, I think, has signed up to testify, but they felt very strongly that there wasn't any reason any longer, now that we weren't filing on paper and that we're in an electronic world, that when reports are due on a certain day, that it had to be 5 p.m. that day, and that it would give people additional time and flexibility in order to get their reports in. And, you know, for us on our end, it really doesn't make any difference in terms of receiving the information. So we're fine with it if advocates feel strongly about it. We're just worried about that one part that you just mentioned.
Follow-up. When it is received, is there automatically an electronic signal that it has been received?
Yes.
So there is clear communication, and if you don't get that by midnight, then you haven't filed by midnight. My own campaign in the past, not probably recent past, since Orstar is so new, has had trouble with getting that electronic, yeah, we got it. And it's very annoying, and I can see treasurers up till midnight waiting on that. And nobody there to call and find out why I didn't get there, I guess, is what I'm visualizing on this, my concern.
Yeah. And go ahead, follow up.
Actually, I have another question, another provision.
Go ahead.
The $500. You knew I. We have all gone to our counties and gotten these public record lists for a very nominal cost. And I'm sort of like gulping, why does it cost so much for the Secretary of State, or you don't know what it costs, when for you know, just a fraction of what you're putting in statute here, you can get this public information from your county. Give me a clue why this is so much. I'm not very satisfied with your explanation.
Well, hopefully I can satisfy you. The $500 fee is for the full statewide list.
Okay.
So it won't cost you $500 for your district list. The charge is... I'm trying to remember exactly what it is. Brenda, maybe you can look it up for me. She's in the back. But it's less than a penny per name. And the maximum you can be charged for a voter registration list is $500. So for those smaller lists, it's much less than that.
Follow-up.
Madam Chair, in other words, the anticipation is that all lists would come from the Secretary of State, and
you can get your list from anybody. You could continue to buy from the county, but those fees are set by rule. And then this one, the cost for a statewide list would be in statute at $500.
Madam Chair, I don't understand why that would cost $500. You're taking a list, you are transferring it onto a data disk and handing somebody the disk. The disk is worth pennies. I'm just not getting why $500 for a statewide list.
Okay. Well, we worked with the counties when we couldn't get any help from our vendor in identifying the actual cost. We worked with the counties and asked them what they had been charging when they all had their individual systems, and came up with a cost that was sort of middle of the road in terms of what counties were charging. Some of the counties were concerned about it because they were going to be losing revenue when we went to the statewide system. It was a potential revenue issue for some counties, and so we went with the middle of the road cost in terms of the per voter fee, and then a maximum cost of $500 for a statewide list, and it was based on what people have been charging for years around the state when we went to the new system.
One more question on this. You indicated that this information is provided free during primary, pre-primary, and pre-general for the political party statewide. What about the 25% independents? They have to pay $500 because they have no organized party to share this information for.
Well, the statute requires us to provide copies of the voter list free to political parties. If you have independent candidates or whatever and would like to look at that statute, we're more than willing to do that.
Madam Chair, one more question on this. Would it be feasible to make this list available free in some format to all folks for a certain, there are minor party candidates. There are. This is a public record list, and I'm really bothered by this $500, and it's free to the parties occasionally. I would like to see a system whereby at some point if you're going to charge this much, and this is a lot of money, that there ought to be a way for all folks at certain times in the electoral process to have access to this critical public information for free or severely reduced cost.
Madam Chair, we're happy to review this situation with you. We think that there is a potential identity theft issue at work here with a charge of giving away this information for free, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this issue forward. My understanding of the statute that says that we're required to provide free copies of the list before each primary and each general to the political parties was that so that they in turn could provide that information to their candidates. And so I think it is available to candidates through their political parties. But
thank you.
Mr.
Lindbeck.
And Mr. Lindbeck, sure. So currently you are charging this $500 fee, is that correct?
That's correct.
So this would not change anything.
That's correct.
It's in statute. Yes, Representative Thatcher, did you have a question?
It was a real simple one, I think. It was just on page 4 of the bill as written. On line 32, the change that is proposed to be made in the A5 amendment, it just changes the may to shall, and I just wondered why.
And that's Representative Buckley's amendment.
Oh, okay. I guess I didn't know who. There you go.
I don't know.
So maybe that question is for you.
thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher. Original legislation that we brought forth a few months back was addressing situations where political action committees did not receive information because the treasurer had a mental health crisis. This way, that it would keep us out of the situation of political action committees getting into that spiral of penalties because of a lack of communication within the committee.
And Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to reiterate a little bit and follow up with what my colleague from Salem had to say about this, about your $500 fee. If you're going to have a fee, you make it even. You charge everyone. You do not make exceptions. That's what I object to on this. If you have to pay, if some citizen has to pay $500 for this list, then so should every political party in the state of Oregon. There shouldn't be any exception to this, and I think $500 is a little too high. I think you need to reevaluate that, because I think if you burn a CD, you burn it for pennies, like the representative from Salem said. More importantly, consistency and fairness is what I think we're about in this state.
And Representative Esquivel, if I understood the testimony correctly, I think there is a statute on the books that requires the Secretary of State to provide a free copy right now to the political parties. So that would have to be repealed in order for them to be able to charge for those copies, which maybe is what we should do.
You should do that.
Yeah. Mr. Lindbeck, did you have a further comment?
No, I thank you, Madam Chair. That was going to be my response. I did get information from Brenda about the actual cost per voter for if you buy less than the statewide. It's 2.5 cents per 100 voters if you buy less than a statewide list.
Madam Chair, is Mr. Yes. Lindbeck prepared to do the math on the numbers in the ORSTAR?
What's that?
Are you prepared to do the mental math and figure out how much that is for the statewide list?
Well, it's 2.5 cents.
Well, that's what the $500 would represent?
No, the $500 is a maximum. You pay no more than $500 for a copy of the list. The fee is 2.5 cents per 100 voters until you reach that maximum. That's why the fee for a statewide list is $500.
How many are on the statewide list?
How many voters do we have in Oregon?
I guess we're just shy of 2 million.
So 2 million divided into $500, probably less than 2.5 by quite a bit.
Yeah.
But maybe somebody has a calculator and will tell us in a minute. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have a very simple question that has nothing to do with the fee. On page 6 of the growth version of the bill, it talks about the a change in terms of how in-session contributions are reported. Since those under House rule now are prohibited, is it fair to assume that nothing in here would change the House rule prohibition? This would only be in a case in terms of applicability to the House if we ever lifted that prohibition on contributions during session.
That's my understanding, Representative Hahn.
Thank you.
And yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you. Just more of a comment, and I'm going along with the 2.5 cents per hundred. When I first started running, I have three different counties, so I had to get lists from three different counties, and then I had to take out of that list just the ones that were in my party. It's a lot of work. I'd much rather, and I had to drive to the county seats to get them. So I mean, and Lane is a little farther away from Coos Bay, and Douglas and all of those things. So from my perspective, having a statewide deal where you can pull it out by your bill is much, much better anyway. It was very frustrating getting my computer people to figure out how to get the three disks to work to get all the information that I needed. And we did pay the 2.5 cents. And if I had very many more counties, I would have gotten I know that I would have paid more if I'd gone county to county than the $500 for the state. So from my perspective, at least, in what I've done, it actually makes sense. It does save a lot of time and effort if you had to pick these up from each county, and I would contend that you would save money over the long term if you had to do this from each county. So.
Thank you. And Vice Chair Beckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Sonnebeck, you mentioned the vendor has not been helpful in determining the price. That concerns me. Why has the vendor been unwilling to provide the information that's been requested?
I don't think it's a matter of willingness. They worked on it. It was just very difficult for them, considering all of the functions of the system, to isolate what the actual cost is of producing a list. And the result of that is you can get into an argument with people about whether or not that automatically then under the law makes it free. And that's why this statute isn't helpful to us, because it doesn't say that we can't charge anything. But what do we do when we are unable to isolate the actual cost of producing the list? We felt we did something reasonable, which was go out and look at what counties had been charging and come up with what we thought was a reasonable fee. And we haven't gotten complaints about the size of the fee, other than from a couple of people about the cost of the statewide list. If they had, I agree with Representative Roblin's comment that under the old system where you had 36 lists and 36 locations, if you had to go to all 36 of those locations and then pay the different fees that the counties had been charging, the effort and the cost was in excess of $500. I mean, this system has improved things considerably.
Madam Chair, if I could follow.
Yes, Vice Chair
Beckley. I guess my concern, Mr. Limick, then, is as technology does advance, people understand the uses of technology and the ability to collect spread data, present data. Do you have any concern people are going to look at this fee and understand 2 years from now, 3 years from now, that it's a process that can be done for $3.95 and the state is charging $500 for that process to be performed?
Well, I guess the other issue, and I'd like to raise it again, is that issue of identity theft. I mean, we have a lot of people concerned about this information, people's addresses, both mailing addresses and home addresses, and their phone numbers, and their names, and their birthdays, and how accessible it is. I mean, we have debates in the election world about whether or not you should put your voter registration list on the Internet. And I, for one, as an elections administrator, I've had to wade into a lot of controversial topics in my time on this job. That's just one that I just don't want to go there, because I think my judgment is that the public would have a fit.
Vice Chair Berger?
One more quick comment, since we brought up this issue again, and I was going to drop it, but I won't. Any identity theft thief with you know, worth their salts, can muster $500 to acquire this information or from the county information. And I would also point out that we had a bill that we have chosen not to hear that would have restricted voter information to nothing but names and take a lot of that birth date and voter history information off the public rolls. It would just be names, and so there are other options for dealing with this issue if we care to, besides the $500, which I don't think protects anybody from anybody who wants this information.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
A final comment on the same thing. My issue, having been involved with keeping records in schools and having requests for some of that information, some which you can and some which you cannot give, and all the stuff that goes with it, when people want a copy, they assume that the only cost is making the copy. They don't consider keeping it updated as part of the cost. They don't consider things like making sure that the information is correct and the kinds of stuff that goes in and out of the office on a regular basis, postcards and others that we've talked about here before, that are going to make sure the database is as accurate as it can be. And I contend that, you know, when we're doing some of these kinds of things, those should be considered part of the cost. And the vendor, how much money we pay the vendor in general on our annual contract, along with the other kinds of stuff, are all those kinds of things. And it gets very complex when you start trying to figure out what does it actually cost to produce this list, because it isn't the same as the time it takes to push a button, in my opinion, the cost. So I understand the complexity, and I guess my feeling is that we have to decide where we think that reasonable expectation is and all those things and what we charge for. So.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. And while we've been debating this, our capable staff has calculated that the cost at 2 million voters works out to 0.00025 cents. I'm not sure. No, that's cents. 0.00025 cents per voters.
So. And 100, because you have to, it's per 100 voters that the 2.5 cents was. It's still well less than a penny.
That's quite a bit less than 2.5 cents per voter.
Per 100 voters.
Per 100 voters. So, further questions, further discussions? Okay, committee members, what is your pleasure on this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I know I want to move the dash 5.
Okay. Well, why don't you make an exploratory move and we'll see what happens.
Madam Chair, I move the dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 78.
Representative Buckley has moved the dash 5 amendment to Senate Bill 78. Is there discussion on the amendment? Is there objection? Amendment is adopted.
I'm not sure where the committee is on this, Madam Chair.
Well, I guess we can discuss it for a minute. There's no motion before us at the moment. I guess I would just say that we could certainly delete the language about the $500 fee. It would not change anything because they are currently charging $500 for a complete copy of the voter file. Right now, I suppose somebody could put in a bill to require the fee to go down or to delete the statute, which isn't in here, well, actually is in here, that requires it to be given for free to political parties. So I certainly am open to putting it up again on Wednesday and letting people get those amendments drafted or whatever else they would like to do. Yes, Vice Chair.
And Madam Chair, we never heard from any of the folks who were the proponents of the midnight thing. These are clearly people.
No, we have. Oh, you're right.
I'm sorry. We
have more witnesses signed up to testify, so we should not be moving the bill yet. Good point.
We're just ready to go.
Yes, the chair was getting a little ahead of herself here. Okay, so we have three more witnesses signed up to testify. I think I'll just call them together. Cappy Eaton, Kevin Neely, and Wendy Johnson, please come forward. Maybe they will clear all of this up for us.
If he has mom, we'll both have to go.
Good morning. Welcome to the Elections Committee. And sorry, I did not ever intend to not hear your testimony. So.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters. As you know, the League is a grassroots nonpartisan political organization, and we encourage participation in government. I'm here to speak very briefly in support of Senate Bill 78. We support the amendment.
You can pull back a little bit from that microphone.
I'd be
very
happy to do that. Thank you. I just came from the state convention where we had to actually be on top of the mic. So
these are very sensitive.
Thank you.
It works better if you're longer there.
We are here to support Senate Bill 78 as amended by the Senate. We think that it's very important that there be a third person who is allowed to represent the committee. The treasurer and the candidate sometimes are not available for immediate action, and we just believe that the OSTAR program, which is now established and in its testing set, is very good. And we support the addition of a third person to assist with the reporting of campaign contributions. That's very, very important to the transparency of government, so the citizens can see what is happening in campaign finance. We certainly encourage campaigns to become trained and use the OSTAR program. We went through some training ourselves last week to see what it was all about, and it's a good program, and we supported its establishment, and we think that it will make a great deal of difference in the reporting requirements for campaign funds. We're not going to get into the argument about whether there should be a five-hour extension and somebody at the other line, but allowing an additional amount of time on that finally deadline day could be very important. We think that the procedures in elections are very important for the transparency of government, and we certainly feel that you should move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely, and I'm here on behalf of CNE Systems, a company that I own that does contribution and expenditure reporting, among other things. And I would add that this is largely my bill. This is a gut and stuff of Senate Bill 78 on the other side, with some issues that we came up with in a small work group that was composed of the Senate Majority Leader, the Senate Minority Leader, and the folks that do what I do on both sides of the aisle. And this is the work product, at least some of this is the work product of that group. And I'll talk about the three provisions that are the provisions that I included in this bill. You've already heard about those from Mr. Lindback, but again, I want to elaborate on a couple based on the questions. The first provision that's in this bill is this ability to file, to appoint a proxy, what I call proxy filer. As you all know, this system is onerous. It's important, but it's also onerous. And it's particularly onerous during the 42 days preceding the election. My company has just concluded elections in the Portland area and Eugene area. We had clients in both those elections. And I can tell you that those campaigns were significantly smaller than even our state representative races. And it was an incredible amount of work to keep on top of the seven-day reporting requirement. What this bill does is it allows folks to designate somebody else. We had a treasurer in one of those committees who had a pre-planned a trip to Mexico, and it was absolutely impossible for him to do his filing. So we had to make special, we literally had to make special arrangements to get in touch with him in Mexico and to find a computer that had internet access in Mexico, all of those things that are going to be problematic as we move forward. What the first provision does is allows you to essentially establish somebody else. I'm going to be out of town for a month. I'm not going to be able to get to a computer. I don't have to worry about it. I can have someone else be responsible for that. Again, I still assume the responsibility that the filing is accurate, but it affords me the ability to go on vacation, to get sick, to do any of those things that might prevent you from filing under the current system. So that's the first provision. The second provision is the one that extends the filing deadline. The reason that this is important are, in my estimation, a couple of there are a couple of key reasons. The first is that the expectation of Orstar already is that it's a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week system. Our office is working literally all hours of the day and night during the crunch of the campaign season. Often my entire staff is there at 1 in the morning trying to get through the crush, and this is preceding the 7-day reporting requirement. This is back when we filed 4 times a year, 5 times a year, 6 times at the most, and we were there all hours. I'm confident that our staff is going to be working all hours, probably even more so come the 7-day reporting when we get to the primary in general in 2008. This affords us the flexibility, if we haven't completed everything by 5 o'clock, to use those extra hours in the day. So that's one reason it's important. The second reason it's important is something we found out in the course of just working on these reports this time of year. Most of the candidates that we have on our roster are actually serving in public positions. And it's not very appropriate for us to call them in the middle of their workday, ask them to get on their public computer, and ask them to file a report. But it is perfectly appropriate for us to call them at 5:10 at their home, or call them at 5:15 on their way home, and say, hey, when you get home, it's really imperative that you get onto your home computer and that you do your campaign business from home. And this will assist us, particularly during that 7-day reporting period, to make sure that those campaign transactions are timely filed, and timely filed from a non-public computer. Right now, on days, if we are pushing up against the deadline, and we often are, we often have to make arrangements to bring a portable computer out to an office, go on a convenient coffee break or lunch break, as you all probably know, and do the reporting then. Again, this will facilitate that reporting beyond 5 o'clock. And I recognize Mr. Limbach's concerns with there not being a warm body, but I can tell you that there are many times in the course of our work when at 1 o'clock in the morning we're trying to get something filed and there's already not a warm body there for us to call, and we're going to have to wait until the morning. If we've procrastinated to the point where that's going to result in a late filing, why, the problem's on us, and we recognize that. But if we can get it done by 5, if we know there's going to be trouble, then we know there's going to be staff there. The third piece of this is something that Representative Hunt discussed earlier. We found what we thought was a little bit of an archaic piece in the old statutes that actually dated back to the express prohibition on campaign contributions that required any contributions from the first day of the year in which there was going to be a session until the starting day of session. It required all of those contributions to be reported within 48 hours. That caused some real significant problems this cycle, partly in part because the Orstar system was a fledgling system and we were still trying to get it working. But again, we recognize that in the future this could be an additional problem. So what we've said is it looks like, based on your legislation that you passed last session, really what you're trying to do is make sure that any contributions are reported in a timely way at the start of session. So this requires any contributions to be filed within 40 that have been received from whenever, go back in time to when the filing 30 days. So if you go back in time 30 days from the start of session, any of the contributions that you would have received from that moment to the start of session must be reported within 48 hours. Again, we thought that was really what the legislature had intended, and that this was just an oversight in the course of drafting that last bill. We want to get all the information. During session, you have to report every 48 hours. Right now, if you received a contribution the day before session, huge contribution, you could receive a $10,000 contribution the day before session, and that contribution wouldn't need to be reported until 30 days into session. What this change in the law does is it says any contribution that you receive must be reported within 48 hours of session, and then it continues the 48-hour reporting throughout the course of the session, which is already the law. So those are the major provisions of this bill. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Again, we recognize that Representative Buckley has a very friendly amendment. I think that it's a good idea. I can tell you from many, many experiences that it's always good to have more than one person get announcements from the Secretary of State's office. That way you know they're caught in a timely way. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Vice. Well, we were going to hold questions.
Yeah, I was going to say everybody, although I think Wendy has a completely different topic she wants to talk about. So why don't we take questions for these two witnesses, and then we'll take Wendy's testimony.
Thank you. Mr. Neely, I have a number of issues here. Your example of the treasurer in Mexico, why didn't you go to the candidate directly and have them file?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, it was not a candidate committee. In that instance, it was an initiative committee, and there's only one, only in initiative and PAC committees, there's only one eligible filer. In candidate committees, there's often candidate committees, and we'll hear from Wendy in a second, have both a treasurer and a candidate. But in many instances, the treasurer is the candidate. And so, again, I think it's important to know that for all of those PACs that are non-candidate PACs, there's only one person that can file. And we're incredibly reliant on that person, and that person can't ever be gone more than 30 days or inaccessible for more than 30 days or 7 days within 42 days of the election.
Okay, I understand.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. And a couple of other, if you don't mind, Madam Chair. One of the things that bothers me a lot is that we've simplified the system by going online, and now everybody has to have professionals do this. You literally don't have any option. I don't know what kind of a simplification that is, but what it does is add to the cost of campaigns in a significant way, and this bothers me a lot. I'm also bothered by the fact that it took us until this session to take polling places off the statute. And we haven't had polling places for quite a few years. On the other hand, ORSTAR started in January, and already we're just assuming that all of these problems are going to be solved by a few word changes in statute, and I'm not at all sure they are. Your argument about, this is preamble, Madam Chair, your argument about, there is one, your argument about the midnight thing, I am still very bothered that there might still be people out here who are not professionals, who are in lower level sort of trying to get through this system on their own without hiring professionals, who still may think that, you know, if I've got to midnight and I have a problem at 11 o'clock, I'm going to call the Secretary of State's office and somebody's going to be able to help me. I'm still not convinced that you're 12. I mean, it's great for you pros, but I'm not at all sure that it's helpful for those that aren't pros. And I guess maybe I still want to hold out hope that there are non-pros who could do this job. Like to respond to that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Berger. Well, I have a couple of thoughts. One, I actually think that the ORSTAR system itself facilitates smaller campaigns who used to use our services, facilitates them doing them on their own. And we have, in fact, seen a number of campaigns that were right at the $50,000 threshold not use our services anymore. And so I think that, in fact, the ORSTAR system has effectively helped those campaigns who in the past barely hit 50,000. At that point, they were required to use us. They had no option. They had to have a vendor. Now those individual campaigns can move away from the vendor side of things. I tend to agree with you. If you're going to be significantly over $50,000, it's not because the system is so complex. It's because the reporting requirements are so the timelines have shifted so significantly that staying on top of it requires a full-time bookkeeper, essentially, or a service like ours during the heart of the campaign season. So I think that, again, for the smaller campaigns, in my view of what's happened with our business, they are, unless they have extra money, they're often moving into doing it themselves, which I think is what the law was intended to do. For the bigger campaigns, as you folks will find when you get into the meat of the campaign season, this system, you're almost going to be required to use a vendor like us, is my guess. So that's the first piece. On the second piece, the timelines, and I can tell you that I'm not that the most important piece of this bill is the proxy piece, obviously, because that's critical for our work. But I can tell you that I do believe that the extension of the time is going to benefit, in fact, the smaller campaigns much more so than it's going to benefit our shop. Our business, we are generally not pushing up on the deadlines for filing. We usually have our work done well in advance because we're filing and keeping accounts up to date every single day. In fact,
I think that it's those campaigns that say, oh my goodness, I forgot to file. It's those volunteer filers who are going to benefit the most from this extension of time. Because again, oftentimes they're only able to work with their with the candidate during those non-business hours, and we're not saying that if you know you're going to have concerns that you shouldn't do that work before 5 o'clock. I think most people understand that the state has a business day, and that they need to get their work done in the course of that business day, and that they're getting some bonus time as long as they don't have any questions. And again, I think that if traditionally the Secretary of State has been at least try to get something in, is what we're always told. Listen, we know you're bumping against the deadline. Just try to get something in. This gives folks a few extra hours to try to get something in. It may not be 100% accurate. They may be able to go in the next day, call the Secretary of State, and say, hey, we had a whole bunch of problems filing last night, but we got something in. Please treat us, you know, be lenient on us. Again, I'm not sure if that convinces you, Representative Berger. I think it's a complex issue, but we're not saying that. I mean, this is just bonus time, essentially. A little bit more time to get your work done, a little bit more time to make sure that that stuff gets filed. Otherwise, there's absolutely no incentive to file it that day. You're going to be pushing it off to the next day and getting the fine.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, Ms. Eden, do you have any thoughts on the $500 price tag for the statewide list? Does the league have any position on that?
Chair Rosa, Representative Buckley, no, we don't, really. We think public records should be made open to the public, but there are some... we discussed this with Secretary of State's office, but we didn't come up to any particular conclusion.
Thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Eaton or Mr. Neely? Okay. Wendy, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. As Mr. Neely sort of segued, my issue to raise before you today isn't really related to what's in the bill, but what might be added to the bill if it would be a friendly amendment. The Law Commission, as you all know, was asked to do a set of recommendations to this assembly regarding the area of ethics reform. Ethics is generally in Chapter 244, which is under the Government Standards and Practices Commission, their jurisdiction. The Law Commission did look at the other area that influences public officials besides Chapter 244, the ethics chapter, looked at Chapter 260, which is the campaign contribution area of law, and the Commission made a couple of recommendations in that area. The issue that has not been heard this session is the issue of who should serve as a treasurer for a principal campaign committee. If you look at Senate Bill 78, Section 2, it states that a candidate may serve as the candidate's own treasurer or may appoint and certify to the filing officer the name and address of a treasurer. The Law Commission and the work group virtually unanimously suggested that a principal campaign committee should not have the candidate serving as their own treasurer. The Law Commission's recommendation did have two exceptions for small campaigns under $2,000 and if the campaign was funded solely by personal funds. But the Law Commission's recommendation is that a candidate should not serve as their own treasurer. I don't know whether that indeed would be a friendly amendment to this bill, but I'm here today just to put that on the record that this might be a vehicle to put that provision in. The vehicle that it's in right now doesn't appear to be going anywhere, and so we were looking literally for a proper relating clause. Because it is in Chapter 260, it can't be put into an ethics reform bill because it's an elections issue. I'd be happy to explain more the policy reasons why that recommendation was made. But I think, as Mr. Neely pointed out, there are generally two people that are responsible, the candidate and the treasurer. If you look farther in sub 3, they both are responsible, but in some campaigns there is only one person.
Okay, are there questions for Ms. Johnson? And I guess I have one. So you did provide us with a list of current members of the legislature anyway, and we could see that a handful were serving as their own treasurers, but what I noticed is that even more had their spouses serving as their treasurers, or in many cases had an employee, whether it was a campaign manager or a legislative assistant, serving as their treasurer. So I guess my question to you would be, isn't there just as much of a potential for abuse if you've got a family member or an employee serving as your treasurer? I mean, if you're serving as your own treasurer, it seems to me the buck stops with you, which it does anyway, because you're responsible no matter who your treasurer is.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I would agree that the appearance of impropriety is probably just as much there, but they're putting two persons on the committee for responsibility seem to be at least a first step. But it's also just, it keeps in mind the philosophy, which is that it is not the candidate's money, that it is a committee that's in that money is in trust for the candidate's election. And if the candidate is the treasurer, that the abuse potential is always there. And so having at least two people was what the work group and the commission suggested as at least a first step.
So your proposal is not only to prohibit candidates from serving as their own treasurers, but to require a treasurer and one other person to be responsible. Is that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, actually, no, that's present law, that the candidate is always responsible. That's in sub 3 of section 2 of 260.037. That's already present law. I think some people think that the treasurer is responsible, but actually present law says the candidate is as well. But an understanding from the Secretary of State's office, we heard testimony during our work group process that the Secretary of State may only go after the treasurer if the treasurer indeed is the one who's been taking funds and using it for personal use. But both are liable. It's you look at the actions of the parties.
And you're not proposing to change that?
No.
Okay. Okay, questions for Ms. Johnson? I see some sighs, but all right. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very sympathetic to what you're talking about. I guess it's that trying to find that balance there. For how do you encourage people to run for office and simplify their process? Looking for a treasurer is hard. Getting someone to share that responsibility is difficult. But at the same time, the appearance of corruption is a significant factor. Do you have the $2,000 mark? Have you chosen that because that's right now is where we are to sign off on? I'm not going to raise more than $2,000. What are your thoughts about the $2,000 mark and whether that could be perhaps changed upward?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, the $2,000 was a deliberate choosing at the suggestion of Secretary of State's office because of the electronic filing requirements and where those thresholds are. The work group did consider a higher number, but the problem is sometimes you just don't know how much your campaign is going to bring in and not bring in. And so, in fact, for that exception for the $2,000, the Secretary of State's office asked that we require the candidate to designate a treasurer in advance so that if they do go over $2,000, that there is a treasurer on record ready to go, so to take care of that very issue.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How does this pertain to local smaller elections? Example, council members in Medford spend, $5,000 to $10,000 on a campaign. Would that come under this jurisdiction? And the reason I ask that, what was very difficult for me on a smaller campaign was to get a treasurer that would say, let's say you had a $3,000 or $4,000 campaign, they'd look at the laws and say, wait a minute, you can imprison me and fine me up to $10,000. Why am I doing this?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel, the Law Commission and the work group did discuss that issue. The Law Commission's bill regarding this provision would allow for insurance, which is a pretty common practice for a campaign to pay for insurance for those liability issues. It would not protect literally the stealing portion if that would happen, but the misfilings or the late filings and that type of thing you'd still be permitted to use your campaign contributions to pay for that. So the balance, we were looking at that balance of, well, how do you get a treasurer, but also looking at the problems that have faced the state in terms of candidates serving as their own treasurer.
Okay, other questions? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just thinking about the very scenario you brought up, and often candidates will have their spouses serve as a treasurer. And I think one of the reasons is because last year we passed a law saying that only the treasurer or the candidate can sign a check. And it's just a matter of convenience. If you've got somebody that's across town and you need a check for something, the candidate's gone, you know, campaigning, and you need to have something paid for, you're not allowed to designate another person to sign a check the way the law is right now. Maybe that's something we need to look at, because I think it would be better for appearances and otherwise to have somebody other than your spouse serve as a treasurer, or certainly not the candidate serving as a treasurer. It seems like it would be incumbent upon the candidate to be able to assign somebody else to sign a check, and that's currently not the case. So I think that's something that we should address.
But the treasurer, I mean, you can certainly have a treasurer of your own choosing who can sign checks right now. It isn't a requirement that it be.
I understand, but it's a matter of convenience. If you've got, if you would have to go traipse across town to get a check signed, I need this check signed to be able to pay this bill, you know, somebody closer into the function of where checks are being made, it just seems like that's a little constricting, not being able to assign somebody else to sign a check.
Oh, I see. So you're actually suggesting a different change from what they're proposing, which is that somebody other than the treasurer or the candidate
being able to sign a check, and that would also make it easier to assign somebody other than a spouse to be a treasurer, I think.
I see what you're saying. Okay, other questions for Ms. Johnson? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Members, I sense that committee members have some changes they would like to propose to this bill before we vote on it, so we won't be taking it up for a vote today. I think what I will do is carry it over until Friday. I think I'll carry it over until this Friday, and we'll put it on the schedule for Friday. And we're also just looking at our start time, and I think we're going to move up our start time for Friday from 8:30 to 8 a.m. so that we will have time to work it then. And I'll close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 78. And I'll open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3294. And it looks like we have quite a few people to testify on this. No one has signed up that they're further than 100 miles from home to come here, but is there anyone of our witnesses who traveled more than 100 miles? Because we will take you ahead of other people if you did. And Representative Hunt, we will take you first. Yes, Mr. Stenbridge, please tell us what
House Bill 1394 requires the Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs to consult with county veterans officers when carrying out veteran service programs involving county veteran service officers. You have the -7 amendment from Representative Hunt.
Representative Hunt, good to see you.
Nice to be here. I'm glad we started with the non-controversial bill this morning. You have a... Sean was handing out a fact sheet for the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. You'll notice the original version of this bill started off with a very simple change. As the Veterans Affairs Committee looked at this issue, several other possible changes were suggested, really dealing with the whole issue of how veterans are served, how county veteran service officers function. If I could just walk through this this sheet that has the 5 points of the basic changes in here. One is a very simple change, and actually much of the text of the proposed amendment is just deleting the word war before veteran in a whole series of sections. That's just really an effort to make it more inclusive, to make sure that we are actually covering all veterans, whether they specifically served in the theater of war or not. So all the changes, it says section 1 on your list, but it's really sections 1 through 11, which are just deleting the word war from a whole series of sections, which is something that the Veterans Affairs Committee agreed was a valuable change to make to make sure we're being inclusive. In section 2, there is a more substantive change. It's at the top of page 2 of the -7 amendments. It deletes a single sentence from statute right now that right now says the appointment, and this is referring to the director, the appointment of the Director of Veterans Affairs, may not be made without the written approval of the advisory committee. That's the Veterans Affairs Advisory Committee. This is a situation where we really have a very bizarre anomaly in statute right now, where this advisory committee, which serves a very valuable advisory function, but is not it's not like a commission that goes through a whole appointment and confirmation process through the Senate, like the Fish and Wildlife Commission or the Liquor Control Commission. Those commissions where they've actually gone through a vetting process and gone through a legislative confirmation process, they actually do have some involvement in the hiring of, in that case, the director of those agencies. This advisory committee is appointed. These are appointed folks. They are not subject to legislative confirmation. And so having them involved in the hiring process of the Director of Veterans Affairs is, I think it's the only case in statute where that is true, and it seems like a very strange situation. Section 12, if you jump all the way ahead to page 8 of the DAS 7 amendments, it adds a criteria to the distribution formula for these funds. You will recall that we as a state give funds to the counties to help fund county veteran service officers. There has been an inequity that has come up in the way those funds are distributed, where they are not necessarily always distributed proportionally to the number of veterans residing in each county. Now, I should note there is kind of a strange situation where Marion and Polk County, because the Department of Veterans Affairs is headquartered here, there are specific state veteran service officers that specifically serve veterans in Marion and Polk County, and that seems to function well as not a problem. So this really applies to the other 34 counties to make sure that when funds are allocated, and this was the case where we significantly increased the funding last session, where those funds are allocated, that they are allocated proportionally, you see based on the criteria there, according to the number of veterans residing in each county. As I've talked with Representative Boquist and Senator Johnson, there has been an effort for 07-09, because the budget process was already moving forward. They have just taken some action in the budget to help correct the inequity in the formula for the coming biennium. So you'll see that this would not apply until the following biennium, and to basically make sure that we've got not just a one biennium fix, but a more permanent fix. The core issue I'd encourage you to think about, when a call comes in, when a veteran calls into the 800 number that our state provides for veterans, they are asked where they live. And assuming they don't live in Marion or Polk County, they are directed out to the county veteran service officer for their county, whether that's Jackson County or Multnomah County or Coos County or Clackamas County. And this would make sure that those dollars that we as a state are investing are going out to the place where we are referring veterans for services. Section 13, if you flip over to page 9, the Department of Veterans Affairs was actually very helpful in coming up with this language. In a case where a county actually reduces or eliminates county support for veteran service officers, because as I noted, we provide some funding, but the counties also provide some funding. Where there is a reduction in that county support, because we intentionally are providing these dollars not so the county will just say, oh, good, there's state money now, we can back out our county money. This says if the county does try and back out the county money, the state money is not going to be provided to the county. But it also guarantees that those funds will be used specifically to serve the veterans in that specific county. So we want to set up some disincentive for counties to pull out dollars, especially if we as a state continue to invest in this program. But so that there's a penalty for the county, but not a penalty for the veterans that live in that county. And finally, in Section 14, which was the core issue in the original bill, which was really trying to make sure that the State Department of Veterans Affairs and these county veteran service officers work collaboratively to set up training and certification. We've got a situation where there has not always been the greatest collaboration between the county VSOs and the state. I think it's important that there is collaboration. This will set up a training and certification committee, and you can see the specific functions they will serve. And that will be made up of three folks that are nominated by the county veteran service officers and three folks that are appointed by the Director of Veterans Affairs to make sure that there is some collaboration. I will tell you, as is often true in these areas, as I've had a lot of conversations with both the Department of Veterans Affairs and the county VSOs, neither of them fully like these amendments as drafted. I think, as I've talked with Representative Boquist and Senator Johnson, who have dealt with a lot of these issues, I'm feeling very confident about where these amendments are right now. But I think it is fair to say that because there's not always been great relationship between the county VSOs and the department, this is trying to in some ways, I was going to use the term force, encourage, maybe force, some greater collaboration and working relationship, but also set up some changes that I think are needed based on the history we've seen.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Yes, questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hunt, who hires the County Veteran Service Officers?
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Buckley, they are actually hired as, they are county employees, so they are hired by the counties through a normal county hiring process.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hunt, who appoints this advisory committee? That intrigues me, the way this thing works. I've never quite run into this.
Madam Chair, Representative Escobar, the Veterans Advisory Committee, it's actually on page 5 of the amendment. We don't actually, this doesn't change the appointment process, but it lists out how that works. It's actually appointed by the governor, and it lists the process where nominations can come from. There is, unlike a lot of commissions, though, of the state, there's just not any legislative involvement in confirming those folks. They're just straight gubernatorial appointees.
Other questions for Representative Hunt? Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hunt, this proposal comes out of not the Veterans Affairs Committee's recommendation. I missed the first part of your testimony, so bear with me. But as sort of a smaller work group, what's the provenance, I guess, is the question of these specific proposals?
You bet. Representative Rosenbaum. Mom and Representative Berger, the Veterans Affairs Committee, as they got right up until the April 30th deadline, was not quite ready on amendments, and so I've had an ongoing dialogue back and forth with the department, with the county VSOs, with Representative Boquist, with Senator Johnson, and then with some individual veterans. This is trying to discern what the best pieces are. Some of the more controversial pieces that were in earlier amendments, they were looking at the dash 1 through 6 amendments, have just been left by the wayside.
Yes, this seems really important that we do something this session, and I presume I'm going to hear from folks, critics of this, but I do appreciate that this seems like something we should be doing. And we should be doing it now in terms of getting the state and the counties on the same page in terms of services to veterans. So thank you for at least continuing this process, however this bill turns out.
Okay, other questions for Representative Hunt? Okay, thank you. Why don't you join us up here? We have quite a few people signed up to testify, so I think I'll call them in groups. First, Nicole Pommetier, Wayne Backlund, and... last name is McDonald, and I cannot read the first
Mac.
Name.
Mac.
Okay. Great. Good morning. Please go ahead. You don't need to wait. Just please proceed.
Can I go first? You want me to go first?
Thanks, Mac.
Yeah, you can actually give this to our clerk in the future.
It's almost done. You might as well finish.
Proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Pommetier, and I'm here representing the Oregon County Veteran Service Officers Association. And as a side note, as you all know, I also represent O4AD, and we are also in strong support of that, as many of our area agency offices house the veterans, the County Veteran Service Officers. But on behalf of the County Veteran Service Officers, we are here in full support of House Bill 3294 and the Dash 7 amendments, and we just want to extend our sincere thanks to Representative Hunt and to Senator Johnson for all their work in, as Representative Berger pointed out, making some important and substantial changes and making sure that, as is our goal with the County Veteran Service Officers, we are able to serve veterans regardless of the period of time in which they serve.
be able to serve them to the very best of our ability and to be able to make the collaboration between the county and the state to be as effective as possible. And that is our only goal and our only purpose in being able to be out there at the county serving these veterans. As Representative Hunt went through the amendments, he described them very clearly. I just wanted to make a couple points. We are very supportive of removing the definition of war because that makes it all inclusive to veterans as a whole. And as I talked to legislative council, it's an interesting conversation. If you look at the ORSs, they're sort of a little bit of a hodgepodge as time has gone on of, well, here and then here and here in different time periods. And this starts to make that cleanup happen so that we're not worrying about those different specific time periods. Instead, we can just look at a person who served honorably in the armed forces. To Representative Esquivel's question about the appointment of the director, the recommendations for the advisory committee come from, and I quote from the ORS's executive committees of congressionally chartered veterans organizations that maintain an Oregon state headquarters. In other words, the recommendations for that advisory committee come from the National Service Officers organizations that have a headquarters within the state. So our position is that by putting the governor kind of as that final say in that makes those two things come together, where the recommendations are coming from a national organization in Oregon, the governor also has that state perspective. So we strongly support being able to allow the governor to have that kind of checks and balances with those recommendations. In regard to the distribution formula, as Representative Hunt pointed out, Marion and Polk County do not receive those funds, and they've stated on the record several times, nor do they want to. So sometimes there's questions, why not them? But they like how it is. It works really well for these counties. So I just wanted to throw that out there because we've had that question before. But as an association, we support equitable services and equitable funding for veterans regardless of where they live, whether it's in Multnomah County, whether it's in Jackson, Josephine, or whether you're in Baker County. And with the distribution formula, we've had some issues and dialogues around that as we've gone through the last couple sessions to be able to make sure that is the case. And if it's based on the number of veterans that are within a given county, that seems to be the most fairest way to go about it, because it shouldn't matter where you live when you come back home from serving your country. The education for the County Veteran Service Officers and National Service Officers in Section 14 is an important piece. We believe that being able to have a committee that represents, quote-unquote, both sides but working towards the same service in order to be able to make sure that training is relevant to the service officers who are out there, making sure that our veterans are able to get access to services and supports, and a lot of times be able to plug into a lot of things that they just didn't know was out there. The benefits process is very long and unwieldy, and this allows them to be able to do that. Making sure all those voices are around a table so that it's relevant is a very critical part. The County Veteran Service Officers are trained, they're educated, and accredited, and to make sure that we can provide those services out there, and we maintain that we want to continue to do that. And again, thank you to Representative Hunt for all of his work on this, and we hope that you will pass this out with the -7 amendments and move it on to the floor so we can make those important changes.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, Representative Hunt, I'd like to thank you. My name is Staff Sergeant Wayne Backlund, a retired veteran who was wounded in 2003 in Iraq, spent 19 months in the hospital between Walter Reed and Fort Lewis, Washington. I can't say enough for my Washington County Veterans Service Officers. They've done a tremendous job for me. It's taken since 2004. To the end of 2004 until just recently where I was awarded my disability. So that'll tell you how long it takes. VA has backed up tremendously. And in order to, what I do support is I do support taking out the language of the word war veteran. They're all veterans. They're all brothers of mine and sisters too. And being able to go to any service officer, regardless of war or non-war veteran. It also removes the word of war. I think this is a great bill. I think it'll do a lot of things. I work with Washington County Veterans Service Officers as a work study. I can't do much because I have traumatic brain injury. I suffer from memory loss and things like that. But what I've read here today seems fantastic, and I think it should help a lot for the veterans. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mac McDonald. I represent the United Veterans of Oregon, which includes every nationally chartered veterans organization in the state of Oregon. Last Saturday, we honored our veterans with Armed Forces Day, and I spent it in Corvallis with the Oregon National Guard. Next week, we honor those that have died in combat or died serving the nation in Memorial Day. In November, we honor those who served this nation. The question is, how does this bill help veterans? Everything else doesn't matter. How does this bill help veterans? I want you to know, as far as I know, no veteran had input into this bill. No veterans organization was contacted. I'm in this building 5 days a week. No one said boo to me about this bill. I tried to get the amendment last Thursday and Friday and was told it was not available. I got it at 7:45 this morning. We ask, there are some good parts to this bill, but there are other parts that are left wanting. And I'll go through by page. Page 1, lines 7 through 9, just merely identifies the director, who he is, and the veteran and who he is, and I think the director should stay in. It's just something that identifies who it is when they're in there. On line 11 and 12, other than honorable discharge, should be changed to be discharged under honorable conditions. The way it reads now, some of the bad conduct discharge, an undesirable discharge, or a general discharge under other than honorable conditions would be covered. Therefore, that line should be changed to discharge under honorable conditions. The same with line 14. This bill leaves out those veterans that have served one day in combat. If you served one day in combat and you're hit, wounded, you would not be covered under this. That needs, and that language is in 408.225 at the present time and should not be removed. It also should say anybody that has a combat ribbon should be included. And this would all be not necessary had I been or a veteran been contacted. On page 2, the veterans feel very strongly that the law that has existed for 62 years and really only been used once should stay. We don't believe that politics has any way, shape, or manner should be involved in veterans and veterans' affairs. When Governor Goldschmidt became governor, he tried to appoint a man from California to be the Director of Veterans Affairs, and John Mangus would have been out. The veterans liked John Mangus. We wished him to be remained, and he did remain because of this law. We wish to keep politics totally out of the selection of Director of Veterans Affairs, and we wish to have a say in who is the director. I can't emphasize enough that this needs to stay in, and it only be used if someone is appointed that the veterans don't want. As I said, it's been in existence for 62 years. Page 3 is fine. Page 4 is fine. 5 is fine. 6 is fine. We feel on line 16 on page 7, you can go either way, you can keep it may or go shall, really doesn't make any difference.
And Mac, I think that that change actually comes from legislative council. They're sort of cleaning up the statutes every time shall comes up. They change it, so I don't think it changes the meaning of the law.
On page 8, the Director of Veterans Affairs shall adopt rules for the formula distribution of county governing bodies funds appropriated at the time of the director to enhance and expand the services provided by county veteran service officers appointed under ROS, etc. I want to point out that there are no funds from this state given to most of the national service officers. And we have national service officers are all located in Portland, in Multnomah County. When you go down to lines 17 and 18, the proportional amount allocated in distribution to counties and according to the number of veterans residing in that county, I think it's unfair to 33 counties in this state to not include the National Service Officers, which there are 14 in the federal building in Multnomah County, where most of the veterans go because they can't find the one, I repeat, one national county veteran service officer in Multnomah County. You'd be amazed at the number of calls I get saying he's not available, we can't find him, and he's not located in a separate office. He's under the age and disabled, and most of the veterans in this state are under 50 years of age. What a place to put a veteran service officer. We feel that the national service officers must be included in the distribution of money to county veteran service officers, or you're unfair to 33 counties in this state. On page 9, on line 30, you should include national service officers after the word by and before county, followed by a comma. National service officers serve a very important function. Most counties start claims. Most counties turn to the national service officers to be at the hearings where these claims are heard. In other words, if I'm in Marion County and I put in a claim, when it gets up to the federal building where the national service officers are, where they're talking every day with the people that have the hearings, the national service officers do a much better job supporting veterans than the county veteran service officers, because the hearing officer knows that national service officer. He doesn't know most of the county's veteran service officers. When you do a distribution of monies, those national service officers must be considered. And if I was in the 33 other counties, I'd be madder than hell to say that Multnomah County has one national service officer, they get all this money, and we don't even include the national service officers who do most of their work. The same on page 10, line 1, at training of, you've got to include national service officers in there. They are trained by the state of Oregon, by the Department of Veterans Affairs. On line 8 and 9, after organizations, there needs to be a period that are funded in whole or part by state funds. We need to take that in consideration. The director shall appoint line 16, we want the change. The director should appoint the additional members from a list of nominees, not from the Association of County Veteran Service Officers, which would stack the pack against veterans, possibly, but that the congressionally chartered veterans organizations pick those three people. Because the way it is now, the way it reads now, you would have 4 County Veteran Service Officer representatives up there and 2 from the Department of Veterans Affairs. We feel that's unfair. We feel it's stacking the deck to veterans. those changes would benefit veterans. I'd like to quote you something that was said Memorial Day last year. So for me, doing right by our veterans is a moral responsibility of every American. We owe it to our past. And an investment in the freedom that every American will be able to redeem in the future. That includes veterans organizations and the way veterans think. I represent probably more veterans than anybody else in the state of Oregon when I'm here talking to you. American Legion, VFW, Paralyzed Veterans, Military Order of World Wars, Military Officers Association, etc., and Disabled American Veterans. I can go on and on. They want those changes. They think that this bill is not a good bill the way it is written. Either one or two things. We either want you to make the changes we recommend, or we want you to just say vote no on the bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mac, the National Veteran Service Officers, who pays their salaries?
Their salaries are paid normally by the Veterans Organization. Three of them get a small pittance from the state of Oregon, the VFW American Legion, and I believe Purple Heart. But the Purple Heart had their $29,000 that was in the bill for this year taken and given to Multnomah County. Multnomah County got $100,000 extra, and why, I don't know. If anyone should have got that $100,000, it should have been the National Service Officers who served Multnomah County. I'll be very honest with you. I see Frank Fryer, who's their County Veteran Service Officer, more down here than up in Multnomah County. And when people can't reach him, it's because he's not serving veterans. He's serving County Veteran Service Officers being down here at the legislature. And that's the only County Veteran Service Officer that Multnomah County has. One for 54,000 veterans.
Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mac, do you have a sense off the top of your head about how many members, collectively, all the organizations that you represent?
Probably about 300,000. There's 364,000 veterans.
So you think your organizations actually have 300,000 members in Oregon?
I believe we do.
That would be really helpful if you could follow up more specifically on that. That's
I can I can go down and get the numbers from all the organizations, but
yeah, that'd be great.
The American Legion, VFW, and DAV are, of course, very, very large. Paralyzed veterans are very, very large. But I feel it's probably around between 250 and 300,000 veterans.
Yes, follow up.
Couple of questions for Nicole. Am I correct in my understanding when a veteran, maybe like Mr. Backlund, calls into the 800 number that we set up as a state, that those calls either go into, either stay with the Marion and Polk County, the folks in the state ODVA who serve Marion and Polk County, or those folks are actually directed out to the county VSOs, not the National Veteran Service Officers. Is that correct?
You are correct, Representative Hunt, Madam Chair.
Follow up?
Well, thank you. And in terms of the whole issue related to Multnomah County has come up, my understanding is that the reason that Multnomah County has just one county veteran service officer is because we as a state have not given Multnomah County the proportional share for the number of veterans in that county. Is that a fair assumption?
Representative Hunt, that is a fair assumption because their funding last session was not given at a proportional amount, so one veteran service officer is all that they could afford in that county for the number of services. However, Multnomah County does have any number of statistics if you'd like to see them on the number of calls, the service that's done, as well as there a number of people who are on waiting lists that come to the Multnomah County Veteran Service Officer Office.
Other questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes, go ahead.
Could I answer that a little bit? The reason Multnomah County got less is because the National Veteran Service Officers were included in the formula, as they should be. And that's the reason. Multnomah County was not shortchanged by any stretch of the imagination. Multnomah County, using the national and state veteran service officers in the federal building, were included in Multnomah County, and they should be, because they are utilized by Multnomah County.
Representative Hunt.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mac, based on that statement, Are you saying the National Veteran Service Officers that are based in Portland only serve Multnomah County vets,
no, they
or they serve statewide?
Madam Chair, Representative Hunt, they serve all veterans.
Statewide.
Statewide. However, Multnomah County veterans come there in droves because they cannot find the one veteran service officer in Multnomah County that's hidden down in a behind a disabled and aged section of Multnomah County. In the telephone book, it's even hard to find them. I have people that work for the Department of work with one of the departments here in the state that try to find that man when he was working there. He no longer does because of injuries received in Vietnam, but he's not available. Multnomah County could not operate without national service officers. It's that's a fact. There's no other question about it. And they should be considered when you start allocating funds. They're there. They're there for any veteran in the state. But they serve Multnomah County. They are in Multnomah County, and they should be considered in the distribution of funds. And we feel very strongly on that. I feel very strongly that the state should help support national service officers that do a tremendous job for veterans. They serve veterans 5 days a week and sometimes more. I've called them on Saturday and Sundays when I have a veteran that comes and says, I have a problem. I'm not a service officer, but I know where to go to, and I will call them Saturday or Sunday if, a veteran from Polk County, where I live, has a problem and he's not getting it solved. I'll call the DAV representative, the VFW representative, because I know action will be taken.
Madam Chair, may I speak for a minute?
To answer the last question, and then we do have quite a few more witnesses.
I know. I just do a quick statement, Madam Chair, and Representative Hunt. That's what happened to me in Iraq. I lost all my teeth. I lost all my hearing. I'm a member of the Purple Heart Association. They didn't do squat for me. I'm a member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. They didn't do squat for me. I'm a member of the American Legion. They didn't do squat for me. They got me a temporary disability and left it at that. I am applying for Social Security. I have to support 7 children. I went to combat to honor this country and to fight for the state of Oregon and the United States of America and for my commander-in-chief. The National Service Officers didn't do nothing for me. I had to end up going to my county service officers. Thank you.
Thank you, and I think we'll let you have the last word for this panel. Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for your service. Next, we'll call Harley Ray, Sterile Austin, and Gary Zwicker. Please come forward. Members, we are excused from floor session, although we may see the sergeant in arms. But we'll keep going until we're forced to go to the floor session. Please be seated, and please go ahead. Morning and welcome to the Elections Committee.
I seem to have been elected by a party of 3 to start. For the record, my name is Starl Austin. I currently serve as a member of the Governor's Advisory Committee to the Director of Veterans Affairs. I'm also a former director of the department. I'm a combat veteran of World War II, and I served on active duty in the Korean War, although I did not serve in combat. I came to ask you to reconsider just a couple of issues that are contained in the -7 amendments. First, I believe that you're leaving out a significant group of former or current military service members through the language in Section 1 of the amendments. I applaud the deletion of the term or the word war in defending our veterans. I think that should be done. But from the end of the Korean War until the beginning of the present Iraq-Afghanistan War, there have been very few call-ups of either Guard or Reserve forces to participate in any active-duty actions that could qualify them to serve as veterans. In Oregon, for example, the Oregon Air Guard, and I am a retiree of the Oregon Air Guard and a former commander of the Oregon Air Guard as well, so I'm prejudiced, I suppose, in that respect. But here in Oregon, the Oregon Air Guard, and the Air Force Reserve Unit down the ramp from them in Portland, served on call day and night, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, during the whole period of the Cold War. Some of those people who enlisted and who were out there working weekends on drill days, volunteering to come out at night to do the support work. Now, the air crew members all had to go through pilot training. They got their 178 days of active duty. But the support people, in many cases, went to basic training, period, 90 days. They won't qualify for veterans under the terms of this bill. They're, even though they may stay in the Guard, they get their 20 years, retire from the Guard, and receive a military retiree's pension. So I think that if we're going to deal with the day, changing the day business at all as it relates to these, to that service, that you ought to consider 90 days rather than 178 days. Because that's about what the 90-day period would cover, the basic training that those people went to on active duty. There's one other thing, just a minor item, on page 2 of the Dash 7 Amendments on line 12. It says the advisory committee, advising the department, I think the advisory committee advises the director, not the department. And I think that should be corrected.
Gerald, that's actually the existing law, though.
I still think it should be corrected.
Okay. We'll make note of that.
And I have served in both positions. There's another area that's of major concern to me, and it's been talked about a lot here. I debated whether to even bring it up or not. And that's the matter of the distribution of funds to the county service officers. I would say that the previous testimony on behalf of the County Veteran Service Officers Organization is not what the chairman of the County Veteran Service Officers told me, and I would invite anyone here to call him. That's Tim Jetterberg of Union County. The County Veteran Service Officers Organization authorized the people who are appearing here as their representatives to testify in support of the governor's budget for the department and nothing else. And if you'd like to call Tim Jetterberg and ask him, he'll tell you that too. The distribution of Senate Bill 1100 of the last session was a great bill. It was the first time that the state has really stepped up with general fund money to support outreach to veterans. The director was, in that case, the director was the one who was authorized to decide the distribution formula for that money. But there was also a work group established, which was to look at what the director did and make a report to the legislature, the emergency board. I served on that task force. There were a couple of legislators on there. Senator Johnson was one of them, as was Representative Donna Nelson. There were a legislative fiscal officer's office representative was on that work group, as was the Department of Administrative Services budget officer. And they went through the whole plan, the whole distribution formula that the director had established for Senate Bill 1100 money. And Multnomah County was given, there's a basic distribution over 34 counties. Each county got the same amount. And Multnomah County received that. But the rest of the money was distributed based on the availability of service officers to the people who are residents or veterans of that county. The work group concluded there was adequate veteran service available in Multnomah County because of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs people in this federal building and the national service officers in the federal building. And that three-quarter time, Multnomah County service officer could in no way serve the number of veterans that were in Multnomah County. And reported that fact to the emergency board, and that report was accepted without any changes.
If you could please just wrap up your testimony, because okay, we are going to be called to the floor.
I'm sorry. There are three counties I wanted to talk about. Multnomah is one of them. Washington County does a good job. I will say that right up front here. Multnomah County had 1 3-quarter time service officer until the Senate Bill 1100 money came out. Now they have one full time for their total number of veterans. Marion and Polk counties don't get any money for outreach from Senate Bill 1100 or anything else in the budget. My feeling is that since there are state service officers available in Multnomah and Polk, or in Marion and Polk counties who serve Marion and Polk County veterans, and there are service officers in the federal building in Portland who serve Multnomah County veterans, that at least those three counties ought to be treated equally. Right now, Multnomah County gets money, and even extra money in this budget. Marion and Polk counties get nothing, and there's no way they can get anything because they aren't even listed in it as a line item in the distribution formula that's contained in the department's budget. So I just throw that out to you as a matter of equality. I think Marion and Polk, the director needs some way to receive the Marion and Polk County funds if he's going to serve them. Thank you.
Thank you. And for those in the audience that are waiting for House Bill 2595, we will not be getting to that today, so thanks for your patience. We will. I'm not sure when we're going to take it up. I guess we can carry it over for Wednesday just in case we have time on the agenda, but it may not be until after that. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Harley Ray. I represent the American Legion. I am the Department of Oregon Legislative Chairman. I'm here to say that I strongly support Mac McDonald's voicing what he was talking about, and we of the American Legion go along with what Carl took. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your brevity.
Yeah.
Please go ahead.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm Gary Zwicker, retired Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army. Represent Military Officers Association of America. And just want to say I concur wholeheartedly with what McDonald proposed and also General Austin.
Thank you all for your testimony.
Well, I forgot to tell you that we got a general, a colonel, and a lieutenant colonel here.
Wow, a lot of grass in the room.
And when I went to work at the Department of Veterans Affairs, I told them I was Mr. Austin because veterans don't want to deal with generals.
Good for you. Thanks a lot for your testimony. We'll call Gary Zwicker, Carrie.
Who's this there?
Thanks, Gary. Carrie Wymetaled, I can't quite make that out. And then Katie Harris, were you signed up to testify, Katie? Someone passed me a note.
Just briefly.
Okay, come forward, please. Please go ahead.
Hi.
Oh. Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Katie Harris. I am a disabled veteran. I served in the Army from 1993 to 1999. I am a County Veteran Service Officer and the appointed legislative liaison for the Oregon County Veteran Service Officers Association and a member of that executive board. I just want to let you know that I have talked with Tim Jedeberg, the president of our association, this weekend, and he is in full support of what we testified to today. And if there are any questions referenced that, I would be happy to address it. And if interested, I would be happy to give you his cell phone number for confirmation of that. It's been presented that President Tim Jedeberg has a different view of what has been happening in this legislative session. And I just want to let you know that that is not an accurate statement. And for verification, I would be happy to give you his cell phone number.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, I'm the service officer of my post here in Salem, and I refer quite a few people to the service officers up in Portland, the organizational. I do agree with the chief, with the general, and with MAC, and that's about all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, any questions? Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Mayor.
Did you? I'm sorry. Please identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Carrie Wymetaled.
Madam Chair, my question is for Mr. Wymetaled about the Marion Polk
county sort of construct where there's no county service officers, it goes through the veterans. How is that working for Marion Polk County veterans? Would they be better served to have someone on the ground or going to the vets, the state offices?
I don't have an opinion on that. No.
Thank you. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I'm just curious about Marion Polk. It is a little unusual.
Okay, any other questions for these witnesses? Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House Bill 3294? Yes, please come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doug McElvin. I'm a disabled veteran. I'm the CVSO for Washington County. And I just wanted to say that I support the comments by Representative Hunt. Generally, just some comments off the top of my head about Multnomah County. Of course, we all realize that in the recent past, they had like five service officers. At that time, when they had five service officers, they were able to do full outreach around the county. And it would seem obvious to me that if the additional funds were made available to them through this distribution formula, they could increase their office and perform more outreach around the county. I know that the national service officers in the federal building do a service to all the veterans around the state. I know that the as far as getting into appeals, that we in Washington County largely do our own appeals, but the bulk of appeals are handled whenever the Board of Veterans Appeals show up by the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs in the county, in the federal building. That's taking appeals from all counties from around the state. They do the bulk of the appeals. A very small point. I think it's sometimes a deterrent to people coming to the federal building to visit their officers there. They have to go through the security measures. You have to take your belt off, your shoes off, that sort of thing. I think that's a discouraging factor for veterans who have, for instance, PTSD. It's well known that the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs wants to move the regional office out of downtown Portland to another area, so it's not as burdensome for people to go downtown in Portland. And just a very small point, that minority veterans, black veterans, a huge portion of black veterans in the state live in Multnomah County. I think it'd be a great service to those veterans if there were more county service officers in Multnomah County and could go out and do outreach beyond just the downtown, be more accessible to all the veterans there. I think that'd be a great service to minority veterans, and I support anything that would make funding for service officers, county service officers across the state, more equitable. And I fully support everything that Representative Hunt said, and I look forward to working well with ODVA in the future. And our office works extremely well with the ODVA office in the Portland Federal Building. It's a good relationship we have, and we want to go forward continuing to serve veterans together. But I certainly, again, support everything Representative Hunt said, and I don't think that's inconsistent with other testimony here. I think what he said is right, is directly on point. I thank you very much.
Okay, we've just, thank you very much for your testimony. We've just received a call of the House, which means we are required to report for duty. So I think that completes our witnesses. Thank you all for your excellent testimony. Well, and I will close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3294, and the committee is adjourned.